You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
World shares inched towards a four-month high today, and industrial bellwether metal copper was set for its longest weekly winning streak in nearly 3 years as recovering global data kept nagging coronavirus nerves at bay for now. Now, the market rally, which has been fueled by record U.S. job numbers, had largely blown itself amid a spike in U.S. COVID cases, though the fastest expansion in China's services sector in over a decade and more stimulus ensured optimism remained. Currency and commodity markets also had a subdued feel after an otherwise strong week, and it was always to be this way as U.S. markets are closed ahead of that Independence Day holiday tomorrow. Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, and Raymond Parsons, Professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, as always with your end to the week. Welcome, chaps. Warwick, for you, what shaped markets in the second quarter as we look back on what those forces were and what might potentially unfold in Q3?
Good evening, Michael, to you and to the listeners. I think the main focus of quarter two was really an incredible divergence between markets and the economy. We saw real economies get shredded in an absolutely dreadful way. We still got to find out what the economic body count is, but I think we can get a sense that quarter two GDP around the world is going to be a truly awful tale. In the meantime, however, the process of reflating economies to backstop them and simply keep them going was basically a very blunt instrument. I mean, it was a case of, well, let's run the printing presses till they're smoking hot, and push that through the economy. So whether it was the ECB or the Fed, I mean, they were all extremely busy and extremely expensive. So we saw a jobs bloodbath at the end of quarter one and tapering into the first part of quarter two, followed by a fairly substantial recovery coming through in the next 2 months, and of course a massive recovery in equity markets, which on a normal basis you would say are expecting a incredibly sharp V-shaped recovery. In reality, the central banks are not really particularly concerned about supporting asset markets so much as they are about using them as a transmission mechanism to push cash through the economy and reflate it.
It's stimulus, I think, in one word, that still drives markets. And Raymond, if we look at that stimulus and what's happening here in South Africa, obviously our bazookas are more like pop guns. We haven't had the same ability as the Fed or the ECB or others to print money at that scale. I suppose it shows if you look at the first quarter GDP number, which is likely to get a lot worse in the second quarter.
Yes, hi, Michael. Look, I think it's true that minus 2% growth in the first quarter of this year was bad news, but not news that was unexpected. It was in line with expectations, but above all, it confirmed how vulnerable we already were before the virus hit us. So we know that we're going to see further deep bad news in the second and probably the third quarters of this year in South Africa. And I think by and large, as the supplementary budget and others have indicated, probably for the year as a whole, we're going to see perhaps a minus 8 or perhaps even 9% growth in the year as a whole. And if I might refer also to our Northwest University, its policy uncertainty index this week, saying that uncertainty is going to remain at very high levels. This feeds in with an undercurrent within that minus 2% growth. It said how weak investment was. And as long as you have high levels of uncertainty, you're not going to see any recovery on the investment front. And that's, of course, why we're talking about infrastructure and so forth. But that's absolutely a fundamental catalyst if we want to eventually turn this economy around once we get out of the COVID-19 phase. Having said that, and talking about stimuli and supporting measures, yes, even within our limitations, I think we need to say it was a good idea in the month of April that our government decided that we would have a 500 billion rand support package, which was estimated theoretically at about 10% of GDP. I would just counsel, though, that as we move in the next few months, that I'm not sure it's going to be 10%. I mean, that's what it says on paper. But the fact is, you have to allow for where else is, of course, government spending going to be cut. So you've got to look at the net effect of that. And secondly, there is the whole delivery problem, an issue of implementation. So I think, once again, it's really a bridge. What we did in the supplementary budget and earlier is just a bridge to the mini-budget in October to see how much success we are going to have, given the impact of the lockdown on our economy, how much impact has the support package actually had. And that will, of course, determine what the final numbers look like over the next few months.
Absolutely. It makes it very difficult to forecast in this uncertain environment. And Warwick, well, what doesn't help is contradictory messages. Statements from the NEC being contradicted by Gauteng Premier David Makuro, who's warning that there could be another hard lockdown in Gauteng, where we're seeing a spike in coronavirus cases. I was chatting to Professor Shabir Mahdi earlier today, and it was like a red rag to a bull. He said, absolutely not. It will not have the slightest positive impact. What it will do is maybe delay the peak by another 2 or 3 weeks, but you can't just delay the inevitable forever. And he said the unintended consequences of going back into a hard lockdown are far worse than any of the kind of benefits that you're trying to achieve from this.
Yes, Michael. Look, I think that, politicians involve themselves in basically trying to provoke the right behaviors with a mix of threat and bluster, just in the same way that central banks sometimes try to get the response they want by making use of threatening language without actually carrying through on it. I mean, as far as the NEC goes, my understanding is that the NEC has undertaken to the party that there will be no further lockdown on level 5. I think the awareness of the damage to livelihoods is painfully aware, which leaves us the question, of course, of, well, you know, what actually is the exit, both here and elsewhere in the world, from the whole debacle. And I mean, there's basically three approaches. I mean, the one is, and we obviously all cross our fingers here, that a vaccine comes through. The second is that medicine comes up with cures and therapies that improve the survival rate and other outcomes of victims to the degree that it's a more tolerable illness. So we've seen some progress there in the form of the likes of methotrexate, remdesivir, high-flow oxygen therapies being much more effective than intubation. So, I mean, there is quite good progress in the cure front. But the final point is that if you have sufficient of those cures coming through, and whether or not you have a vaccine, you get to a point where there is social acceptance that the risk is sufficiently minimized that they can go back to some kind of normality. And I suspect that the third one is ultimately where that is going to see us come out. I mean, the vaccine process is a very long, drawn-out one. Perhaps they will come up with one, maybe they won't. But given the rate of spread and so on, I guess number three is probably where we're going to find ourselves pop out of the whole vortex.
But Professor Mahdi seems to be quite confident that this trial that they're working on will be successful. Oxford have an agreement with AstraZeneca that will produce and distribute and manufacture the vaccine. But it's still months away, as he said. You're trying to condense what is usually a 5 to 10 year process into 18 months at best. Now, Raymond, what about this large group of very left-leaning economists, many of them at WITS, now urging Parliament to reject Tito Mboweni's supplementary budget. There was a great riposte in Parliament today. I see Eunice Kurrim didn't take too kindly to Dondo Mogajani defending the Treasury. I don't know why. But effectively, what these economists are saying is that we haven't had what we have had is austerity, and they want more expansion. Well, what have we had over the last 10 years, Raymond, if not expansion, if not adding more debt, if not spending more money as government that got us into the situation in the first place? I mean, who are they trying to kid?
Well, Michael, I think the important point here is that I think, obviously, in the field of economics, and especially in the field of economic policy, there are going to be differences of opinion. I want to come to that in a minute. I think over the past decade or so, what we've seen is really a failure to implement the fiscal consolidation that had been promised. And if it had been done sooner and better, we would not have found ourselves in this particular vulnerable situation. I like to say, as I've said before, per se, I'm not paranoid about debt as such, because what we need to do in this debate is to distinguish between what I call productive debt, where you create assets, and deadweight debt, where you spend on your current consumption. And so we need to sort that out. So it's not the absolute level. It's the fact that really you've mismanaged it in such a way that you now face the risk of a sovereign debt crisis unless you implement certain of the structural reforms. But coming back to that group of economists, I don't want to go into the merits of it. They're entitled to their view. I think what concerns me more about this is the fact that at the moment, it's a very lopsided debate. You've got 100 economists out there expressing their views. You've got the National Treasury on their own trying to defend it, as they did in the last day or so. And I think the important point is you want a proper balance in the debate. You've got to ask yourself, well, why did we create an economic advisory council, which I supported? But, I mean, it had its 15 minutes of fame about 9 months ago. It's been invisible. And if anywhere where the Treasury would want an ally or support, although they may not necessarily agree with everything, but nonetheless, you need that kind of informed debate to come from a structure created by the government and the president for the very reason of addressing these urgent and critical issues and injecting some kind of perspective into the debate. So I think it's very important that if we have a structure, a highly qualified structure like the Economic Advisory Council, that it step up to the plate visibly. Maybe it's had influence behind the scenes, but that's clearly not good enough. So I think given the difficult task that you face in any way in trying to get the right balance in your economic policy, to get the commitment and the implementation that you need to mobilize the structures that are available. And I think other economists also need to step up the plate if they don't agree and say so. Against I might just mention that against the 100 who put in their view, there were two other WITS economists who put the opposite view. But I mean, although it's not a question of numbers, there was a complete lopsidedness also in the coverage of what was said to Parliament this week. So quite clearly, my concern is less we can debate the merits and argue about them as we've done on this program and elsewhere, but I really think this is becoming a very lopsided debate, and we need a much more balanced debate on which a government can take decisions, because this is really bad for credibility and indeed for confidence in the decision-making process.
And Warwick, I think one of the important points that Raymond touches on there is that you do get good debt and bad debt. The problem is we've been borrowing over the last 10 years to spend on government salaries. We haven't been spending on things that lead to long-run growth by unblocking bottlenecks in the economy, things like infrastructure, things like making it easier, more efficient to get our minerals out of the ground to port and out of the country and exported and earning foreign income. And we also shouldn't, as the Treasury mentioned today, confuse people's desire to lend us money with our ability to pay it back.
Oh, absolutely, Michael. I think in terms of where would Mboweni like to go in terms of getting things going. I mean, it would be the area of infrastructure is clearly going to be one of them. It's relatively easy to implement. It generates a lot of jobs when you get it going. So And it can feed off in a number of ways, whether it's in mining, manufacturing, agriculture. I think infrastructure is probably where we're going to see a government response to these economic pressures. And I think the big question, of course, with infrastructure is funding. And I mean, inevitably that means some kind of borrowing or debts situation. And I would expect that we see some kind of facilitation of infrastructure bonds and so on. I mean, it's a market that really is not developed in South Africa. And I think some facilitation of that market is very much in order, whether it's for these large infrastructure projects, water, roads, bridges, and then of course power. I mean, it's always been a relatively structured and constrained environment, but there needs to be some kind of opening up and a bit of give from government. I mean, government claims to have a lot of will there, but there's also a tendency on government to do things the same old way, and I think that's an attitude that's going to have to change, unfortunately.
I'd like to just come in here also, Michael, in support of that and say, look, why in some countries who have far worse debt ratios than we have, you don't have this crisis of confidence? Why? They are able to grow out of their debt because they're saying we're using our debt productively, we have good growth prospects, and so eventually we can run a huge deficit now because in a couple of years' time it will reverse itself. So I think really it's not so much that stakeholders, business, labor are upset by the fact that we're in a bad situation. What's important is, do we look as if we have new answers to be able to get out of it? That's where the confidence lies. Is there confidence in identifying and implementing the solutions? Hope is not a strategy unless it's based on sound confidence. So it's all ultimately, in my humble view, ultimately the bottom line is that you are identifying and implementing solutions to serious problems with credibility and with confidence. And I think it's that balance of praise or blame, if you can put it that way, how that's to be distributed will decide how much credibility and how much confidence you have in able to be able to turn the situation around and to be able to resolve it sooner rather than later.
Raymond Parsons, professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, well put. And Warwick Lucas, chief investment officer at Galileo Asset Managers, with your weekly wrap.